Then I remember getting onto the helicopter. And I think at that point I thought, okay, something is really, really wrong and I might be dying. I basically started hearing things that I didn't hear before. Like it was just very loud metallic sound, like you're in some kind of a machine or an engine or something like that. And all I could see, metal things or parts of a machine or whatever, just little sprockets and things closing down and clicking and opening up. And I thought, okay, if this is what dying is like, I'm not interested. It's like, give me something and put me down or whatever.
Those are the moving words of Yair, who was badly injured in a cycling accident and believes his life was saved by London's air ambulance team. The aim of the service is to take the hospital and advanced trauma medics from the Royal London in Whitechapel directly to the scene of an incident to treat critically injured patients who might otherwise die. Every second counts. The capital has one of the world's most crowded and complex airspaces, and it can be challenging, to say the least, landing the twin-engine, distinctive, bright red Explorer helicopter in such a built-up urban environment. But it's all in a day's work for Chief Pilot Captain Neil Jeffers, who is today's guest on the Convex Conversation. Neil, it's great to see you today and all relaxed on a day off.
Helen, it's a pleasure. It's great to see you again. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really thrilled and I'm really excited to hear what we're going to talk about.
Yes, we're going to talk about you. About you and the service. Now, the helipad at the Royal London's off limits to visitors at the moment. So yeah. We're at Denham Airfield in Buckinghamshire. And I'm guessing this feels very much a second home for you.
It really is. I mean, we might talk about how I came to fly and how I came to learn to fly, etc. But this is where I had my first ever trial lesson. And if I remember, it was probably about May 1997 when I first flew in a helicopter. And I've been working in and out of Denham ever since, for 23 years. And it's nice to be back.
Oh, I'm sure it is. It always feels a really special place to me when I come here with all the little planes and all the gorgeous helicopters. Now, when I first met you on the helipad on top of the hospital, you humbly described yourself as a glorified taxi driver and not so to the rest of us. Tell us, Neil, a bit about your role and the challenges of doing what you do in the capital.
Well, I think I describe myself as a humble taxi driver correctly in comparison to the medics who do the hard work. I think it's incredible the decision making that they have to do. You know, we do a little bit of trickiness. When you look at a job through from the beginning to the end, first the paramedic has to make that critical decision to send the team. Then the pilots make the critical decisions of how to fly and where to land. But then it comes out the medics of having to make, excuse the saying, but it is life and death decisions by the roadside, to me, is the key to it all. I'm being a bit flippant by saying taxi drivers. It is slightly complicated. We have two pilots nowadays and have done ever since. The service has been going for 30 years now. And ever since we started, and I think we approached the CAA 30 years ago and just said, look, this is what we're trying to do. We want to take off from somewhere in London and land wherever we like in London. And it just seemed a crazy notion in those days. So they said, well, okay, but you know, you're going to have two pilots, you're going to have certain aircraft do certain things in certain ways. And we did, and we've been doing it for 30 years ever since. A single job is amazing. You know, you get the bell and two pilots run out. One person gets all the data, the other pilot starts the aircraft, you get airborne. And from sitting, having a cup of tea, as we should be now, we get airborne and you could be somewhere else in London within 10 minutes. And that's really an amazing thing to do.
I feel very privileged to have been on the helipad when you've taken off. And what strikes you as somebody watching is how calm the whole thing is. There is no panic when that alarm goes off.
We have a few mottos. And one of the mottos in this case is slow down. We're trying to go fast. And when I first started, I thought, you know, this is going to be, you know, you're going to have to be in a different level of alertness. You'll be racing around doing things as quick as you can. I'm just going to have to be so switched on. But actually, we don't. You can do things slowly, methodically, and accurately, and still get there much quicker than you ever would in any other way. And having done it for so many years now, you get to a point where, you know, you can just move quickly, efficiently. From the time the bell goes until the time we're airborne is certainly within 4 minutes. And there's a lot of things have to happen. So we do move fairly quickly, but it's a bit of a set piece now. We're all motor programmed and we do it in a smooth, methodical way. So it looks smooth, but our brains are moving quickly.
And that's because of safety, isn't it? Because there's no point paramedics rushing up to the roof and tripping en route. It has to be safe, doesn't it?
I quite like to personally have a little bit of a trot to the aircraft. Dude. It gets me kind of going and just gets the blood flowing, etc. But as soon as we're on the helipad, you shouldn't run on helipads. You shouldn't run around aircraft. So you walk to the aircraft and then you jump in and you get focused. So you're right. We don't want people racing around. When the medics first start with us, they are a little bit like that. And when we have new pilots, they are a little bit bounced. They are a little bit flustered. And it takes a little bit of while to smooth them out. But again, I hope we come across as that. It's sort of smooth, methodical and calm, because that's what we're aiming to be.
And the other thing that strikes you when you see your takeoff for the first time is you take off backwards, don't you?
Yeah, we don't fly all the way to the job backwards, no. We should add very quickly.
That would be if you're in the Red Arrows, you'd do that, yes. Not London's Ambulance Service.
Clever, Red Arrows, exactly. No, so this is a specific takeoff technique called Performance Class 1. What it means is, as you rightly say, we back up and we fly backwards 300 feet and upwards 100 feet. Now, the idea being is if an engine fails at any point at the moment we're backing up, we can actually fly forwards and back down and land on the helipad with the remaining engine with no problem. So every twin engine aircraft has to be designed in such a way with such a profile, the backing out profile, so that they can fly safely and protect their passengers and crew all the time. As soon as we get past that, what we call the takeoff decision point, which is the bit where we start flying forward, we then have enough speed and energy to survive an engine failure. We can continue flying, land wherever we like, at an airfield maybe.
And am I right in thinking that as the pilot, you don't know what the task is?
And this is a really interesting point. Being humans, we suffer the human condition a lot. We worry a little bit about people confirming their bias. You're suffering the red mist, if we've heard that expression before. You know, if we know that a certain patient, like a child particularly, is at the end of this flight, we might fly in a different way. So the captain of the aircraft certainly doesn't know what they're going to, and the co-pilot has to go through a few menus to find out what we're going to. We tend not to know, and we try not to know, because we want to fly in exactly the same way always. Now, I try and extend that to the medics. I say, you guys don't need to know what you're going to. You have the skills to deal with absolutely everything. There is a danger that if they turn up and say, or they hear that it's a person with a broken right leg, a head injury, and they might be expecting a person with a broken right leg and a head injury. Because quite often what we go to is not what we expect to go to, because it's very fast moving. Information, communication, language, etc., quite often leads to the job we're expecting to go to not being exactly as we hear it. So I think personally it's better that we don't know what we're going to and just fly the same way everywhere we do.
And as somebody who doesn't fly, who would love to fly but can't fly, our listeners are going to be fascinated, Neil, with some of the most tricky places you've landed, the most beautiful places, the most challenging. I mean, you have to land that helicopter on a sixpence sometimes. We've all seen pictures of it in places like Trafalgar Square or outside of Parliament. What are your personal stories that stick out from unusual places you've had to land?
Yeah, well, I should explain a little bit about, you know, how we assess those sites and how big they should be. We are the second most regulated industry in the UK, and so we have lots of rules and regulations. So we should land in sites that are what we call 2D. And 1D is from the rotors to the tail. So twice that is the size of a tennis court. So essentially, we can land anywhere we like in London, as long as it is the size of a tennis court. And from the air, they're quite tricky to assess. When I first started, you'd look down and go, well, isn't it? It could be, couldn't it? Could we go here? Now, luckily, over the years, it becomes a little bit more black and white. You can look down and go, that's where we can fit. That's where we can land safely. And it takes a little bit of training and we get used to it. And over the years, we do end up in some places. And certainly with certain camera angles, it looks tighter than it should be. But we always land in the designated right size of sight, of course. Some of the places I do remember. We land on the top of multi-storey car parks, in box junctions, Piccadilly Circus next to Eros, Oxford Circus, all of those places. But one I do remember, which was quite fun, was the bridge in Kingston. That was an unusual one. And one particularly, which I don't think we'd do again nowadays, but was on Kensington High Street. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes, I am.
Unfortunately, this was many years ago and the rules were slightly different in those days, but there was a patient who had been run over by a dump truck. Full of concrete, unfortunately. The closest places we could land was Hyde Park. So we landed in Hyde Park and moved the medical team down, and this patient was critically injured and needed to be flown to hospital. And in those days, we only had one hospital to fly the patient. But luckily, with a pilot on the ground, having two pilots, one of the pilot went forward, the medics were there, we could actually secure the area. So we asked people to move the chairs, move a couple of cars, move the awnings back, and we did fly and land in the middle of Kensington High Street, picked up that patient and flew them to hospital as quickly as we can. Really important, and I'm glad we did it, but the rules are probably different now. We probably wouldn't do it anymore. Sorry to ramble, I'm rambling a little bit.
Not rambling at all, this is what we want.
Another thing important to mention is that it's a common misconception that we fly a lot of patients around from A to B. I think most people think that the key to it all is putting a patient in the back of the aircraft and getting them to hospital as quick as we can. Not so. The trick to what we do is delivering two doctors and a paramedic with all their specialist equipment, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about the medical things they do a little bit later, to their side, stop what we might call the dying process or slow the dying process, buy them that time, and then usually drive them by land ambulance to one of the four major trauma centres in London. So essentially the helicopter has done its job by delivering that team as close as we possibly can to the patient and as quick as we can. That's kind of the aim of our service at the moment. I do have to add that we do carry patients, but just not so often nowadays.
Your service, I think, is very different to a rural service, because a rural air ambulance service, presumably if you're a farmer and you've fallen out of a tree in your orchard and you've got a broken leg, you know, the whole point of the air ambulance is to pick you up and quickly get you to hospital. You are actually taking the hospital to the roadside, which leads us very nicely to some of those world first procedures that your medical teams have actually performed.
Yeah.
On the streets, in a park, outside. What sort of things do you do? What sort of things do they do for patients who, as you say, may be in their dying moments?
I will apply my normal phrase. You know, we should have a medic here to tell you this in fine detail, but I can tell you what I know. And if they're wrong, I'm sure they'll correct me soon enough. But so many years ago, one of the problems, one of the clinical conditions that people were dying of was a thing called a tamponade. That is where there's a bag around your heart, which is a leathery bag. If that's injured in some way, for example, stabbed, then your heart still pumps blood out, but it pumps it into this bag, and that squashes the heart and can stop the heart from beating. So many, many years ago, well, how are we going to overcome this? So we said, well, we can get people to open people's chests, so do a surgical operation to open people's chests and deliver the heart, get to the heart and solve the problem there and then. And it's incredulous. You can possibly do that. You know, surgeons in a clinical environment have to do that. That's the only way you can do it. But we taught our guys to do it, and they are anesthetics or emergency department guys to do this procedure. And now, and it's not a great thing, but unfortunately, we do it nearly once a week. We probably have the highest success rate of anybody in the world in doing this procedure. And essentially what it does is one doctor goes either side and opens the chest up, gets to the heart, can find this pericardial sac around the heart, can sew up a hole in the heart itself, and maybe even get the heart quite often going again and get them to hospital. And that buys us again that time to get them to surgery to do the procedures. That's one of the procedures that has had a big success over the years.
And carrying whole blood, wasn't that a first for the LAA too?
Yeah, I think just carrying blood on an air ambulance. A lot of services have done it, started looking at doing it around the world. But we were certainly one of the first to bring whole blood to patients. Many years ago, it was deemed that to try and save people would be to just get their blood pressure back up. It was clear that blood pressure was falling. So let's get fluid into them to build up that blood pressure again. And we just used a salty water to do it. And that salty water clearly doesn't transmit the oxygen, etc., that blood normally does. So then you would give them constituent parts of blood, of which there are many constituents. And I'm going to get this one, but plasma and all sorts of things. But if you can give blood, whole blood, that's appropriate to the patient, not only going to save their lives, but it's going to stop the clots forming in the wrong places. It's going to do what the patient requires blood to do. And that was really important. And still we're developing as we go.
Your beat, if you like, is also very different to a rural service.
Yeah.
In terms of the call outs you get. And, you know, when the 5,000 or 6,999 calls that happen every day in London are made, we're dealing with very different things here, aren't we? I mean, in terms of stabbings, shootings, terrorism, things like that. Will you give us an idea of the sorts of things that you go out most to?
Yeah, so last year we did about 1,700 jobs or so, and that's about what we generally do. So we're up to about 40,000 missions now that we've done over the 30 years of working. Those jobs we can roughly split up into thirds, rough thirds. But the biggest of the thirds is, unfortunately, what we would call penetrating trauma, which is shootings and stabbings. The next third is road traffic collisions. In the old days, I don't know if I'm referring to the old days, but cars used to crash and people get injured inside the cars. Cars are so much safer nowadays, we don't see that. But we do see people being struck by cyclists, struck by motorcyclists, run over by lorries and run over by cars. So that's the second biggest third. The other third is people fallen, jumped, pushed off buildings or high. One of our most important innovations is how we are tasked. Because we need to get the right people. As you said, 6,099 calls a day. We only go to about 7 of them. And they have to be the right ones. We don't want to go to a patient that we can help, of course, but we don't want to miss the big, important patient that we can do the most with. So we have a criteria, a specific criteria for just pushing the button. One of our paramedics sits in the ambulance control center and just monitors all those calls. And if he sees a specific, he or she sees a specific call, we'll just press the button and we go. And those calls are someone fallen off a building, but only if it's greater than 2 stories. Someone hit by a car that remains underneath the car. Someone's hit by a train. And these are examples of the immediate call-outs. There are few and far between that are so decisive. The other call-outs are interrogation, where a paramedic will get on the phone and just start talking to the people on the ground. Having a paramedic making that telephone call and speaking to the call provider or the giver is the most important thing, because they can say, well, how's the person sound? What do they look like? What happened? Can you see a bullseye on the windscreen, car windscreen? All these little indicators of what has happened to the patient couldn't be picked up by someone who's just dispatching an ambulance. So that's a really important innovation.
Because you really are going to the patients who, without you, would highly be likely to die at the scene.
I think that's absolutely fair to say. You know, certainly I have an absolute privilege of being able to go down to scene and watch these guys and girls work. And you can tell immediately, you know, where these guys, how hard they're working and what they're doing to get to that point, to just buy that patient more time to get them to hospital. It becomes mechanical, but they work very hard to do it.
And it doesn't always have a happy ending, Neil, does it? I mean, you know, in your job, you deal with death. And I'm sure there are many times when you go home and that day you may have lost a patient, not you personally, but the team have not been able to save somebody's life. How do you cope with that personally? What's your sort of switch off? Because it's very different, for example, to my day. I never go home with that burden or upset on my shoulders.
I think there's a few things. We as pilots could go down and see what's going on and just not like it and walk away. And that's fine. That's a coping mechanism. And this is a terrible phrase, but the blood and guts, the mechanical side of it, you very much get used to. And you can help out, and as I do, as much as I possibly can. But I think there's an emotional element that people don't consider that much. And I think it's families. I think it's grieving parents. I think it's kids being involved. That does have an effect and does weigh you down over time. And I think probably I've been really lucky. There's probably been only 3 events over the years that have really affected me, and I really had to think about them a few times. And I think you do get over it, you compartmentalize it, etc. But for me, there are 2 things that helps. One of them is running. I just love to get out and just run, and that just frees me, and that's brilliant. Although not so much at the moment, another story. The second part is the way we talk about it. It's such a tight-knit team. You know, there are 5 people in that aircraft dealing with adversity. It's like being in the army again, as I was in the Territorial Army for a few years previously. It's like being that tight-knit. You will do anything for that person, and you will talk. There's a bit of black humour, so we make little jokes about it, etc., which sounds terrible. But again, it's one of those coping mechanisms. And I think just being able to talk freely with those people and just discuss anything is probably the most important part of it.
And I notice now you've got a helipad garden, which I've not seen yet. And I would imagine that's probably quite a nice place at the end of the day sometimes to hang out with your colleagues and have that bit of black humour or just talk through what happened.
When the weather's suitable. We're 320 feet up there, it gets quite windy, but it's really important. You know, one of the pilots put that garden in place and just thought it might be a place that we can bring families up to and see what we do and feel what we do. Importantly, they will get a sense of how we do and what we do. We'll take them to the garden, and that's the place where we can debrief and chat in a sort of a less clinical environment. And we do decompress there. We have our morning briefings there every single morning. The pilots, the doctors, the paramedics, the fire crew, everyone on the helipad gets together for a group morning briefing. We discuss all the threats of the day. We discuss everything, and that's where we do it.
It is quite a magical place to me. I mean, you've got that big H sign. It's not for Helen, I don't think, is it?
Should be.
Yeah, that's what you said. I'm sure you said that when we went up there the first time.
It should be.
But it's Europe's highest helipad, and you do feel on top of the world up there. And it's got magnificent views of places like Canary Wharf and the city. There's something quite adrenaline-fueled, certainly, for me about being up there. It's quite special, isn't it, your helipad?
It is super special. Now, I'm clearly a bit blasé having gone up there all the time, but when I walk up there, particularly up the ramp, you walk up that ramp and there's that slow reveal as you can just see the tips of the rotors and then a little bit more of the helicopter, a bit more, then suddenly the same height as the platform with no railings around it. You can see the whole of City of London and then this bright red helicopter, which looks purposeful. It looks mean, it looks ready. It is just amazing. And I think when the weather's right, you know, it's an amazing place for photographs. And I think when we try and tell people what we do, you know, trying to do it over this sort of medium is difficult, but doable. And you're doing an amazing job and it's brilliant. But to get people there, to talk to people, to feel it, to see it, is a great privilege and it's brilliant.
The other thing I'd like to ask you about before we move on to a bit more of your story and then later the aftercare that patients you help get, I'd like to talk about the fact that sometimes you are landing in an active situation by the very nature of the call-outs you get. So if you get called to a stabbing or a shooting, that incident may still be going on. There are dangerous times, aren't they, when you land and you're not quite sure what to expect. What sort of stories stick out from those kinds of experiences, Neil?
There have been quite a few of those things, and we will never deploy the medics on the ground until we know it's safe. So sometimes you know someone's been stabbed. From the air, we have an absolute privilege of looking down and making a really accurate assessment of who's where and what's going on. And the guys in the ambulance control centre don't have that opportunity to see that. But you can get caught out. And I certainly remember flying on the really dreadful Drummer Rigby mission. We had been tasked to someone who had been run over and stabbed, was all we had heard. And that's not unusual, and there are plenty of jobs like that. It's a MO, a modus operandi for gangs, etc. We landed in a small school, and I went down to help the medics, and we walked out, and it was very quickly clear that poor Drummer Rigby was in a bad way, but there were these two other guys who had been shot by the police, but were very much still at large, and were around and seeking our attention. We went to their side to help them, because we had no idea what had gone on. It's only when we actually put one of those terrorists in the back of the aircraft and flew them through all London Hospital that the police on the ground said, look, don't you worry. As soon as you get to the hospital, there will be police on the helipad. We'll look after you at that end. It's only then when we started saying, well, what is going on? And only, you know, within the next few minutes, an hour, we suddenly realized what had actually happened at that point. And we'd actually flown one of those terrorists who was totally compliant, who had been shot, but we flew them back to the hospital. So you can get into places. And so Westminster Bridge was another example of not landing until we know it's perfectly safe. We do our best to assess the scene from the air, but it is dynamic and there are lots of things going on.
Just for those who may be listening who don't remember that story, you just remind us of the Rigby story.
Yes, this is a terrible event. A young soldier who came out of his barracks and was walking down the street and was clearly targeted by two terrorists, extremists. They ran over him in the car first to slow him down, and they got out and with machetes and knives, brutally and fatally injured him. The police were fairly quickly on scene and detained and shot one of the terrorists, if I remember. And that was, I forget now, do you remember, 5 years ago now, 6 years ago, something like that? But
I remember it very clearly. I remember the news footage being very shocking at the time. Would that maybe fall into one of those stories that took you a bit more time to process? Because the thought that you did actually have a terrorist in the aircraft is, to me, feels quite frightening, but...
Yeah, no, I don't think so. When we started to identify that this event had taken place, you know, we were armed with some extra drugs, should we need to subdue him in flight.
It's
one of our protocols.
Is it?
Yeah, we can, you know, like you see in the movies, give someone an injection and you can make them fall asleep. You know, that was one of the processes. But you talk to this guy and it didn't really dawn on me that. And subsequently, having thought about it, you know, he's unarmed, you know, he's naked, he is compliant. He is strapped up. He's in a vacuum mattress, which we put all our patients in. And that's largely just to keep them comfortable, etc. So the threat was minor. Now, I think that the jobs that have affected me are the more emotional kids and families type jobs.
I suppose as a father yourself, the ones involving kids are probably a bit more heart-wrenching if they haven't had such a good positive result. Yeah. I should just say that we're listening to the sound. Yeah. You can probably hear the sound of, what do you think it is, Neil?
I know it's an R44.
Is it an R44, do you? I quite like the sound in the background. It is lovely.
And I haven't even looked. I must look just to make sure I'm right. But
is it an R44?
It is. Having flown them for many thousands of hours and taken off from that exact spot.
That would have been quite embarrassing if you'd got that wrong, wouldn't it? I am saying a Cessna.
I wouldn't admit it to it.
No, exactly. Because you know I wouldn't know.
Exactly.
Where does your love of flying come from?
God, that's a good question. I don't even know. I think it's just been brought up with it for many years and just being immersed in it. Via osmosis, it's just come about. I wonder, you do hear of families where, you know, my father's a policeman, the army, or everything runs in seams, I think. And I think being brought up in aviation, being brought up around planes and seeing them and having a fascination and then being able to get in them and fly them, as I was luckily able to do, it just evolves. And you know, people say, you know, would you like diving? No, I don't want to be underwater. I want to be in the air. I think I'm really lucky still. I have friends who have done similar amount of hours and they just say, yeah, I'm just a pilot. I just fly around and I just can't believe it. I'm still totally in awe. Every aircraft that goes past, I will run outside and watch them fly past. I will watch all the programs. I'm just still immersed in it. And I'm not sure where it's come from, but it's there.
So does it come from Dad, do you think? Dad was in the Royal Air Force, wasn't he?
Yeah, so I think that's where probably a good part of it. I remember many memories of Dad flying, but he's done a lot of really interesting things. He started off flying Vulcan bombers, and then used to display them as well. So a lot of the aerial displays of Vulcan bombers was my father flying around. So that's when I first started being aware of it. He was a multi-engine guy. One day, in fact, I remember him saying, if I had my time again, I'd probably fly helicopters.
Did he really?
And I think that's probably where I thought, right, well, that's what I'm going to do. He flew Nimrods as well. And I certainly remember being in quarters at an RAF base and just seeing, you know, my dad run out and put his dry suit on in the middle of the night. No, we've got a tactical evaluation, TACEVAL. We got off, we could do things, and they go off and disappear for days on end. And, you know, just to see that, them roaring down the runway and landing, it's just brilliant. And I think I've loved it. But my first ever go of flying was when my father commanded a university air squadron at Liverpool. So all the young university kids were all learning to fly there, and I had the opportunity to learn to fly. But I was only 8 years old.
You were only eight.
So he would hand me control and I couldn't reach the pedals terribly well, but I certainly got a feel. And that feeling, and I wish I could get everybody in a helicopter and let them have a go, or a plane, but just a feel. You move the controls and a little bit later the aircraft moves, and it's amazing. And I think great if everybody could do that. So that's where I probably got it from.
Which aircraft did you say that was when you were eight?
That was in a Bulldog. A Bulldog is a little two-seat plane that they used to train RAF guys on many years ago. So it's a little two-seat propeller piston engine plane.
So when did you first fly a helicopter, and did you get your plane license first?
I have to admit, do not have my plane license.
Oh my goodness.
Now I can fly planes, well, not officially, but I can. I've flown simulators and had the privilege of going to work with British Airways with some CRM stuff before and be able to fly their simulators. So I reckon I can have a good go.
I trust you, even though you don't have a license for plane. I would absolutely feel I was in safe hands.
I would give it a go, at least. But I do remember there were two events probably over the years that sort of emboldened my helicopter thing. One of them was, my father was quite senior in the RAF. He used to command a unit called JARIC, which is the Joint Aerial Reconnaissance Intelligence Centre. And helicopters used to come in and out of there. So on a family's day, a Puma came in, a Puma helicopter, big twin-engine military helicopter. They said, oh, if you want to go on there, you know, have a ride in the back. So that was great, flew around that. Another time, a Gazelle helicopter came in, which is a single-engine, two-seat helicopter. One guy got out and said, look, do you want to come in? Do you want to hop in and fly this? I don't think many kids, RAF kids, were allowed to do this, but in those days I was able to. So I took off from RAF Brampton, flew around in the Gazelle and landed again. And that was probably another thing I thought, right, this has got to be the way forward. So that was it.
Your very first solo flight once you'd qualified in a helicopter, did you get that feeling where you're in the air and you think, oh, I've actually got to bring this down by myself?
There are two events in my earliest flying that I remember. The first ever was my trial lesson, which I mentioned was May 1997. And I remember flying with a lady called Glenda Wild, and she was my instructor. And I remember taking off from this airfield and flying over the lakes, which if you've ever flown, you'll know the lakes, flying to a place called Maple Cross. And I still have a clear image of just looking down and just for the first time properly feeling control of the stick and going, my goodness, you know, this, I can make this go where I like and up and down and left and right. This is amazing. And I think I took to it really quickly and easily and therefore was lucky to get my PPL within about 4 weeks, which is quite a quick time in those days. So that was probably one of the most important times. And the other time I do remember was downwind on my first ever solo circuit. I've done a lot of instructing to get someone to do that, is you've just got to just let them do it. You've taught them as much as you can. And I trusted my instructor. And I remember taking off into the hover, which is a little bit wobbly. And then as you do, you move over to the runway, make the radio call, and speed off down the grass, you know, a few feet. And then you get to the right speed, 60 knots, and start climbing. And I remember being downwind and just looking across and just going, this whole space in here is mine. I know what to do, but anything in this whole space is mine, the seat is mine, everything, I can go where I like. I remember it clearly.
What's really lovely about this as you talk is you can see that real sparkle in your eye, and you can see that you're just born to be in the air and that it never feels a chore. I mean, I can tell you feel really privileged to do the job you do, but you love the freedom, don't you, of being out there and up there in your own space.
Well, I think the word privilege is totally understated in how we describe my role. Involved with the medics, and I have some medic, I've volunteered for the ambulance service and I've done some medicine in the army years ago. So having that, being able to help people, being involved with the medics, flying a helicopter, flying in London, it just could not be better. And to add to that, having the privilege of being called the chief pilot of London Ambulance is crazy. The title is much bigger than I ever will be. I'm holding the job for someone else, I'm sure. But it is just an exceptional privilege to be able to do all of those things in one go.
They're not designed to be up there, though, are they, Neil, really?
Well,
I think they're not.
I think you could condense everything you need to know about the fluid dynamics and aerodynamics of helicopters to about three different things. And I think if I sat down with someone, I think the biggest stigma people have is how difficult it is. I think, and I'm going to step out here, I think it's easier to teach someone to fly a helicopter, and I'm going to say fly a helicopter, but to get the basics of a helicopter than it is to learn to drive a car.
So now take the challenge on it. Take me on. Let's have a go.
You're going to think I'm mad, but it's psychology. I think if you teach someone to drive a car, my mother can drive a car, my grandmother can drive a car, how hard can it be? But actually, you've got three pedals and only 2 feet. You've got a gear stick, which is counterintuitive. You move it backwards, forwards, backwards. When you've got to press the left pedal, it's actually not designed. But a helicopter, you sit in the controls. If you move one of the controls, I can get a five-year-old kid in a helicopter and just give them the lever, which is the control, which is next to the pilot's left-hand leg. Hold on to that control. And if you want to go up, do whatever you think you've got to do to it. If you want to go down, do whatever you think you're going to do. And within about 30 seconds, they will have gone up and gone down and worked out how it works.
And you soon realise that the cows get bigger and the cows get smaller.
They do. How's the bigger, how's smaller? And the other control's the same. It's designed to work.
Yair's words, Neil, were so powerful at the start of our podcast. In 2016, he had a traumatic pelvic injury when he was knocked off his bike. So I've just picked another little clip for us to listen to. This is what he remembers of his accident.
I stopped at the junction, obviously looking at the cars behind me, cars coming the other side. There was a car in the junction. I stopped just in front of that car. I saw him. I thought he saw me, but obviously he didn't. So as I was ready to turn right, he basically went straight into me and over me. I heard a crunch. Right now, obviously, me thinking, it's my bike, it's very expensive carbon fiber bike, blah, blah, blah. So, of course, the bike is ruined. But it was actually my bones that were cracking.
Well, yeah, I had surgery at the roadside and was then given ketamine, which is normally, the medics told him, associated with horses to stop him moving and causing more damage. I mean, the medics, what they do at the roadside is really quite extraordinary, isn't it, Neil?
I think it's developed rapidly over the years as well. I mean, the sort of the concoction, dare I say it, of drugs that they give patients to fine-tune the balance of how well their blood coagulates, forms clots, how their blood pressure is, what the heart rate is, finely tuning their carbon dioxide in their blood to protect their brains. It is a balancing act. I think many years ago, the sort of the errors that were made were errors of ignorance. We just didn't quite know what we were doing. And now, if we were to make any errors, which is really difficult to do in this environment nowadays, we make errors of ineptitude because there's so many things that we have to do to a patient. So many different drugs, so many different interventions that it's tricky. And it's a privilege to watch them do it all the time.
And it doesn't end there, which is also something very special and unique about London's ambulance. I've been lucky enough to meet Frank, your colleague. Yes. Tell me about Frank and the role that he's created for himself, which has now been replicated in some other air ambulance teams across the country.
Very, very much so. So where did it start? I think so many years ago, a patient would come into the system. They would be dramatically injured. We would do as much as we could. They would go to hospital. And we applaud the medics for everything they do, but we forget to applaud the patients. Their trajectory from then on is exceptional. They have to learn how to relive their life in a different way. Their rehabilitation, financial, legal, there's a whole many multitude of things that the patients were going through that we had no exposure to. We would try and follow them up and just see how well they were, make sure they were getting better and et cetera, but hold on a minute, maybe if someone who lost their leg a few years ago could speak to someone who has just lost their leg, then maybe they could explain that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe there is a way forward. Maybe if we join those patients together, we could do that. So Frank, who is exceptional, got together and designed this role. And what he now does is supports every single patient, more importantly, their families and the doctors and paramedics that were involved with that, put them together so that they go on this journey together and they learn and they get the information they need when they need it, whether that be legal or help. Frank is there to help them. And he's been brilliant in bringing patients that we have seen by the roadside back to the helipad to see us so that they can see closure, they can get a feel for what we do and how we do it. And it's helped the patients, the doctors, the paramedics, the pilots and everybody more than we can think.
It's interesting there that you mentioned somebody losing a limb, because often the injuries that people suffer when the air ambulance has been called out are life-changing injuries, because otherwise you wouldn't have been called in the first place. But let's have a listen to Victoria, who lost a leg when she came off her bike.
And I do get asked this quite a lot. It's kind of like what was it like when you realised that you lost your leg? But it doesn't, I don't think it really happens that way, because certainly not for me anyway, because I was on so many drugs when I was in the coma. And then you slowly come out of it, and people tell you the whole time, yeah, that you've lost your leg, but I don't think your emotions really catch up with it in the same way. So it's not like a kind of sudden realization. It's kind of, you know it's happened, and then the emotional stuff kind of comes later.
I think Neil Victoria is a perfect example of somebody who had to adapt to a very new way of living after her accident.
Absolutely. And of all people, Victoria, who's a great friend, I would say has been the strongest. I have no idea how she would do it. I would never be able to do it as well as she does. But her positive attitude, her mental attitude, you just couldn't see a bad side. So I ran through the desert doing the Marathon des Sables to try and raise money. I ran with her sister. But sure enough, Victoria came out to Morocco to meet us there and to walk with us for the final bit. She swam across the channel with one leg. She is endless and she's brilliant. She's adapted, and we couldn't wish for any better result from a terrible incident.
It's funny you mentioned the Marathon des Sables there, because it's astonishing to me to think that the LAA is a charity. And I was absolutely bowled over to learn when I first was lucky enough to meet you all that you rely on £9 or £10 million of donations a year to keep the helicopter flying 365 days a year throughout the hours of daylight to keep saving lives. And I know that as a team, you do get involved in things like that, don't you, in your private time to raise money?
We do. All of us, all the pilots, all the paramedics, etc., we all try and do our little bit here and there, whether it's talks or events, etc. So people have climbed mountains, Three Peaks races, and et cetera, try and do this. And we've been lucky enough to be involved with a few of them. I think the money that we do raise not only goes to the helicopter and staff, et cetera, but to the cars. We have a squadron, dare I say it now, of cars. So we have 8 cars, response cars. The aircraft doesn't fly at night. Landing at night is just an extra complication and risk. So they drive around with exactly the same people and exactly the same staff in cars to try and get to patients as quickly as we can. So it's the staff and the helicopter and the cars that we need to raise money for. But you're right, it's a charity. The doctors and the paramedics are paid for. but the rest of it is literally shaking tins. It's not just the shaking of tins, you know, we also, the lottery, and there are other mechanisms that charities use to try and raise the money. One thing that's always amazed me is that when we land, 70% of the time, people are just not quite sure who we are and what we're doing. So not only do we need to raise the money, we just need to raise the profile and just let people know who we are, what we do, and that we will be there for them just as much as anybody else.
Well, we will be raising your profile next week when you dangle me and
yes,
my
you lunatic.
Blind friend Amma Latif off the top of the helipad. Every year you do a charity abseil, which is how I first got involved with London's Air Ambulance and how I first ended up meeting you and the team. So I'll be abseiling, I can't remember how many feet it is, 284 feet, is it?
You're absolutely right. But really importantly, and I still, you're amazing to do this, but it's not the normal abseil, it's a vertical abseil. Abseil 280 feet, not touching any other building, vertically down from our helipad. And I think you guys are amazing, and fair play to you.
I remember the first time I did it was with Tim Vincent from Blue Peter.
Oh, yes.
And as we were coming down, it was really quite clear that people in the operating theatres and wards hadn't necessarily been told that we were on our way down on ropes, and they didn't really recognise me, but they definitely recognised Tim. And you could see some patients in their gowns, and I could see the sort of cogs ticking in their heads, like, have they given me too many drugs? Because I'm sure I can see Tim Vincent from Blue Peter outside the window. I'm not scared of heights, so I don't find the thing very scary, except for the bit when you go over the top and you look into a stranger's eyes and you say, am I tied on correctly? Because people always say, oh, well, you know, if anything goes wrong, you're in the right place. Of course you're not in the right place. If anything goes wrong, you know, just a little splat on the floor 284 feet below. So I do hope their tyres on, but I'm going to do it with Amma Latif, who many people will know, well, not just from our podcast, but he got to the semi-finals of Celebrity MasterChef, the first ever blind contestant. And this is payback for me because he made me climb Mount Toopkal last year and be his guide. So I'm paying him back.
Well, I think you're brilliant, and thank you so much for getting involved and doing that. It's super helpful. It's brilliant. Thank you.
They can dangle me off the helipad, but I'm afraid you won't get me on the marathon.
Yeah.
Neil, thanks so much for sharing your personal story today and giving us such a brilliant insight into London's Air Ambulance. And it's an extraordinary service. I've loved being just a little part of it from time to time. So do keep going with what you're doing. It's really, really appreciated.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your support, as always. Thank you.
Well, you've been listening to Captain Neil Jeffers, Chief Pilot of London's Air Ambulance, Captain_Dude on Twitter. If you'd like to give him a follow, he does post some amazing pictures from the helipad, and it's fantastic to find out on his Twitter feed, actually, what he's up to work-wise with the LAA. It really is astonishing to think that LAA is run as a charity and does rely on around £9 or £10 million worth of donations to keep saving lives 365 days a year. So if you do want to make a donation, perhaps for our abseil or to London's Air Ambulance, do get in touch on socials. I'm at Helen Fospero on Instagram and at Lady Fosk on Twitter, and we'll connect you to the right people. Thanks very much for listening today. The Convex Conversation is available on Spotify and Apple and Google Podcasts, so do tell your friends or pass on the link convex.podbean.com. Goodbye from Denham Airfield, and I'll see you next week.